Welcome to a new episode of Software Gone Wild, a podcast in which we discuss real-life network programming and SDN solutions. Speaking about SDN, the funny thing about it is that once you forget all the orthodox ideas of separating control and data plane, and you focus on what we should be doing, which is network programmability, you quickly realize that we've been doing things that could rightfully be called SDN for decades, only we never talked about them. Well, now and then everyone makes a mistake and writes about what they're doing. And one of these people is John Herbert, who described something called the F script on his blog a few days ago. And obviously, I immediately reached out to him and asked him whether he would be willing to tell us more about his software. Just in case you stumbled upon this recording by accident, I'm Ivan Pepelniak, blogging at ipspace.net. And as I said, with me today is John Herbert. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. How are you, Ivan?
Pretty good, thank you. We got the electricity back, so I'm good. Now, John, you're the first time on my show. Thank you for coming.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Do tell people who you are, what you're doing, how you came to networking, and what brought you into programming.
Sure. As you said, my name's John Herbert. I'm a network consultant. I'm originally from the UK, as you may have gathered from my accent, but I moved out to Atlanta, Georgia a few years ago in the United States. I've got a CCIE route switch from back in 2001, so I've stayed mainly Cisco-focused with what I do, but I play with Juniper equipment too and touch on other stuff, load balancers like F5s and things like that too. I do a bit of blogging, not quite up to your level, Ivan, but I do try and post things out there that I think might be useful or interesting to the community. That's all of my spare time. For the day job, I work for a professional services company, so I take whatever skills I might have and use them to benefit other people, which is kind of weird if you're used to working in an enterprise or you know, working for a company and having your own network. It's always for someone else's. The good thing is I get to see lots of different network designs, lots of different approaches to design, maintenance, and management of networks. I get to meet loads of people. Yeah, the bad thing is you never know where you're going to be, and it's never your network. But I do get a chance when I get engaged on a longer-term project to really see how a team operates and identify areas where maybe there's something I can do to help improve things, even if it's just for my own selfish reasons. And it's actually those kind of engagements is how I kind of got into doing some little scripts, because when you go into an environment and realize that either you or other people are doing the same thing time and time again, and you realize we're doing it manually, you start thinking, okay, maybe I can make this a bit easier somehow. Yeah, you know, as a silly example, I had a client maybe 8-9 years ago where we were creating Cisco VPN configs, IPsec configs, and same thing every time. It's almost boilerplate what you have to do. And yet we still had errors in there. People got their masks the wrong way around in the ACLs and this kind of thing. So I said to myself, okay, fine. I'll write a little Perl script that, you know, you can drag and drop a text file onto this in a little template format that would then take the information you gave it from the client request, and it will spew out all of the router configs you need, plus some related router configs that people often forgot to add in as well. Nothing major, but a huge time saver. With a note that, like all scripts, right, garbage in, garbage out. Yeah, if you fill in the template wrong, there's no helping you. So that kind of thing gets me into writing a tool that's going to help me be more productive in one way or another, or is going to help the company, you know, reduce the time they're wasting doing tasks that really aren't deserving of people's time.
I could only wish that more people would be like you.
Well, you've got to give them time. That's one of the challenges with scripting, right? Is it's something you tend to end up doing in the evenings on your own, because you know, the clients are rarely paying you to write automation tools for them.
Yeah, at least at this moment, and it's on all of us to make them aware that they should be paying us for that, and we should approach that as a serious project, not as evening hacking, which is what we do today.
It certainly is.
By the way, out of pure curiosity, because I am a Perl lover, why did you choose Perl?
Because I'm not really a programmer, and it's the only thing I can handle. So I started programming in Perl probably when I was 20 years ago. I think that's probably about right.
That sounds about right, yeah.
And where I was writing some shell scripts with sed and awk and sort and all sorts of stuff to process text files, And somebody said, right, this is very clever, but why don't you go write it in a proper language now, try Perl. So I said, all right then. And I tend to find when you're trying to learn a language, the best way to learn it is to have a task that you actually want to accomplish. I'm not interested in programming poker games that I'm never going to play. I want to do something specific and focus on that, and I have a motivation to finish that. And so I redid my task, the job I had originally, I redid that in Perl. And then once I realized I could do all this cool stuff with Perl, I started writing more stuff in Perl. And this was all Unix-based, so it was all everything I was doing was text files. And that skill has come back time and time again to save me time and effort and to allow me to analyze things that I couldn't have done by hand. Just because I can process text files like a demon, right? So, so it's really that's and that's why Perl is, because 20 years ago, I don't believe there was a Python. There certainly wasn't a Ruby, but Perl was pretty much everywhere. I could go on to almost any Unix system and either have it installed or it would be there already. It's the same reason you learn how to edit in VI, right? It's the editor that's on every system, whereas Emacs or Pico or whatever you like to use might not be there. But whereas that's kind of a constant. So that's why Perl.
By the way, now that you talked about how you wrote this script for different customers, how do you solve the unique snowflake problem that we always experience in the networks? How can you reuse scripts from one customer to another?
Carefully. it's actually a really big problem, because you end up quite often, in order to cut corners, you end up making assumptions and writing in algorithmic exceptions based on information that you know based on that customer. And it's actually something I fight with quite a lot, is how to make something reusable. Some things are inherently reusable, but a lot of them are very customer specific. And that's actually a real problem in terms of, you know, the bigger picture of, it'd be great to have a tool that does VPN configurations for you. Yeah, but there are so many things that factor into that. It's very hard to know how you can write one generic tool that's going to work in every environment unless you offer lots of customization options to tweak it to what that customer needs. So I'm not sure I have solved that problem. Certainly within my realm anyway, I think that problem is alive and kicking.
It definitely is. Now, you mentioned the F script in your blog post. What is that, and how did you get that interesting name?
Well, so the F script, it's named well, because when you have something you want to run through the tool, you can say, I can't figure this out myself, just F it. And that works very well. So it was originally short for find IP. And the idea of find IP is what it says in the name. It's there to, if you give it an IP address, so you give it F1234, you know, 1.2.3.4, it will do its best to figure out where that IP lives in your network. And if you've got a big network, and especially if you've got complicated data centers with multiple VRFs, routing instances, multiple VLANs, many subnets, many routing devices, it's a real pain sometimes to know where to start, even to start trying to track down an IP address. And yeah, more often than not, the server folks, all they know is, here's the IP of my server, I have a problem with it. So the idea was to try and get something that would help shorten that task for me and get me much faster to where I needed to be. Before the tool, I was doing what I guess a lot of people do, which is I have a configuration archive. I can run a grep on that, a Unix search, and look for the IP address I'm looking for. Well, that's great, but if it's a server, its chances are it's not in your router configs, right? So, well, maybe we drop off the last octet and see how we do with that. That might give you something. On the other hand, depending on your subnet masks, it might also give you a bunch of other interfaces that aren't related, but just happen to have the same three first octets. And I got kind of tired of that. So basically what F does is it'll analyze any, as it stands, any of the configurations we have that are archived daily. So it'll take NXOS, it'll take Junos, it will take F5 archives as well, and ScreenOS as well, and passes those configurations in order to generate a list of interfaces and subnets. So now, instead of looking for a specific IP when I try and do a match, I'm actually looking for which subnets would this IP sit on. And what's nice about that is, if you have a VLAN that has a router on it, or a couple of routers with VRRP running maybe. There might also be an F5 on that same subnet, because it might be a server-side VLAN as well. When you do a search for that IP, it's going to match on both those devices. And it'll tell you, I don't have an exact match for the IP, but I see that that subnet also matched, you know, these two core routers, these two F5 load balancers. And by the way, here's the VLAN it's on. Here's the partition it's on the load balancers. Here's the routing instance it's on the core routers. And you immediately now know where to go. And that alone can often tell you, just knowing the VRF something's in, can tell you a whole bunch about what kind of trouble you're about to be in. For me, that's been a huge time saver, because, you know, if I don't know where to start, I don't know what routing instance I'm looking in. Yeah, if you're on Juniper, for example, and you do a show route for an IP, you know, if you've got 50 routing instances, you're going to get 50 answers. And I found it's very, very easy to skip over what is, in fact, a very obvious directly connected interface in there while you're churning through, right? If you don't know what the routing instance is, well, what are you looking for? The F-script gets around that because it goes and finds it for you. Now you've got that information, it can also spew out DNS host files or equivalent thereof that can be used to generate names for all of your network interfaces for your devices. I mean, why not? It's passing the configurations anyway. And on the firewalls, you can optionally get it to search firewall objects. So if you want to know which IP, if I have an IP, which groups on a firewall or which addresses would it match, it can go off and tell you which address book entries match on a particular IP, so that you can shortcut some of your research into a firewall. And it does the same with F5s. It'll tell you things like, you know, the IP's a VIP, or it's part of a NAT pool or a SNAT pool, or it's a pool member, it's a node. Again, just any extra contextual information that can help you get to the source of the problem faster. Right? It turns out it's also quite useful when you get law enforcement requests for what is this IP that's been doing something bad. It's fairly easy to drop it in, and you get an answer saying it's part of this NAT pool on this device in this partition, and you now know which service something came from. So I'm talking a lot, but it's turned out to be an incredibly useful tool for something that's relatively simple.
Well, you should talk a lot. I like the tool. Now, just to summarize, so it's effectively an offline analyzer of router, firewall, load balancer, VPN concentrator configurations.
Yeah, that's the idea. So it runs once a day, just as a cron job. It's set up a few hours after the configurations should have been dumped up there, updated in the daily archive. And in fact, it's actually a distributed system, because my current customer has multiple data centers. It's very inefficient to pass around all of the config files between all the data centers so that they can analyze on every box. So it's actually set up to do all the analysis locally on each box and then sync up the data files, the actual search files across all the boxes. And now you can run the same tool and get results from other data centers too. And that tool is now feeding into other scripts that I'm writing, because now I can take an IP and I can figure out what the host name is. Well, based on that, I now know what data center it's in because of the host naming standard, and I can use that information to drive other behavior. Again, this problem of it being, as you said earlier, of being, you know, very restricted to a single client where you make assumptions based on their host naming, for example, that's exactly what comes into play. But it does help us get things achieved.
Well, if nothing else, you could abstract that a little bit so that you define an object in a separate file where the users of your program could customize that object to do their own business logic processing, if you wish.
Exactly. And you know, one of the things when you write your own tools is you cut corners because you can. And then you have to go back later and go, okay, now how do I tidy this up? How do I make this more generic? How do I abstract this and get away from all the little shortcuts you took? And it's a surprisingly big effort.
Oh, yeah, it's called refactoring, by the way. And there are whole blogs written about that.
Well, yeah, as you can tell, I've not read them. But and as I said earlier, this is the thing. I'm not a great programmer. I'm definitely a hacker, but I can achieve a goal. Within reason.
Yeah, neither am I. I'm just reading this stuff. So how big is the network that you are now monitoring with the F-script?
At the moment, I've got that set up in three or four data centers. IP address-wise, it's monitoring about, I think it's about 48,000 IPs right now. That's 48,000 IPs or subnets, which is that's basically the number of entries it's pulled out of the files that are active somewhere in the network. So that includes, you know, each VIP is obviously a SASH32 entry in that lookup, and so forth. So that's kind of the scale of it. It's a lot of IPs. The nice thing is the data format, it's very hacky, but it'll search those 48,000 odd in less than a second and give you an answer back, which I think is pretty decent.
In Perl?
Yes.
Wow, that's amazing.
It's surprising.
Yeah, definitely. Now, how is your organization using it? Daily troubleshooting, anything else?
That's the biggest use. Well, it's a mixture of troubleshooting, and it gets used a lot when you're writing a change script. You know, people give you IPs. You know, the first thing I go and do is I go look stuff up and figure out where they are, because it helps you figure out what the network path is going to be that you're dealing with. So I use it as an investigative tool, as part of a research tool for making changes or designing new services for the network, as well as when you're troubleshooting. It's a great go-to tool to figure out where things are. And as I mentioned earlier, I'm starting to incorporate that there are some flags on the script that will get it, for example, rather than giving a longer textual output that's more human-friendly, there are some flags on the script that will give output that's more useful to a script to use in line. Right? So if you have something that simply gives a host name of an exact match, then I can use that host name to go off and process something else based on the answer to that. So I'm using that script in line now within other scripts as a data source.
Interesting. Any other future plans?
With that tool, I'm not sure. It may well have got as far as it's got. The biggest problem I have right now is I just have to maintain it. So as we change load balancer vendor, I have to figure out how to pass that configuration as well. As we, you know, if we bring in iOS instead of just NXOS, I have to figure out how to pass that as well. And that's as much a problem for scripts as anything else, is you have to figure out a way, once you wrote it, you don't get to walk away from them. If once they get in use, there's an expectation of support. So I don't think there's an awful lot more right now. That people aren't asking for more features. It seems to do what it does. The things that I'm looking for elsewhere are more automating other tasks and just using that to feed into it. But I think the F script itself has probably hit about where it's going to get to, at least for the moment.
Oh, there's one thing that you might do with it. I was running an SDN workshop earlier this week, and there were security people and the network planning people sitting in the room. And as you can imagine, they had interesting discussions. And one of them was along the lines of, how long does it take to provision a new firewall rule, and how many things can go wrong? So could one use your tool to figure out what the path would be from server A to server B, and how many firewalls that would hit, and how many firewall rules you would need to enter in there?
I would say not on its own, but it's an interesting concept. I think once you get into that, we're into hop-by-hop analysis, and that's something we're talking about for a number of other tools as well. But it definitely gets more complicated once you have to start following routes and actually trying to daisy chain what you're doing from device to device. And at that point, it really has to be interactive as well. So I have some of that sort of in the works for that kind of logical process. I'm working on a script at the moment to, somebody made a comment on the blog and said they'd written a script ages ago that, you know, if you give it an IP, would go track down the MAC address down to an access port. I thought, yeah, that's actually quite useful. I've had to do that way too many times, and I'm kind of sick of, you know, looking at the ARP table to find the MAC, looking at the MAC in order to find the bridge table entry, and then track to the next device. It would be nice to have a script to do that. And that's doing exactly that. It's real-time interactive. It'll go to the first jump the first layer 3 device and try and track down, use LLDP to find the neighbors. Now, how does it find the first device? Well, guess what? It uses the F script to figure out what the first router is it can find that's on that subnet so that it can get an ARP. So I'm trying to reuse like that, but I'm not sure if I'm good enough to do end-to-end path analysis yet.
Well, the router is doing that for you. You just have to extract the routing table.
Well, that's true. And I will say that writing this current script, I'm trying to do it, I'm going to say in quotes, the right way and use netconf. And I'm walking into a world of pain, I think, is the honest way to put it.
Oh, yeah.
It's and I've mentioned some of this on my blog before, but the inconsistencies between the vendors, even down to, I was complaining on Twitter last night, even down to, you know, the different TCP ports and the different subsystem names that Cisco and Juniper use in order to just get to NetConf in the first place. It's like, you know, we talk about, you know, when you're trying to do automation and trying to do tasks, the first thing you do is gather facts, right? You want to know, what am I talking to? Oh, it's a Nexus box. Okay, I know to use Nexus XML then. Well, the problem with this is you have to know the kind of box before you've even connected to it in order to figure out what device it is, because otherwise you connect to the wrong port. And so you end up having to write a whole bunch of conditional code of, well, let me try connecting on this port. If that doesn't work, try port 830. If that doesn't work, try port 22 and change the subsystem. And eventually you figure out, if this connected with this subsystem and this port, then it must be NXOS. And that kind of thing drives me mad. It's like, you know, without that kind of consistency, it really does make making network automation more difficult than it actually should be. It's very frustrating to me.
Yeah, and you didn't even go into how some vendors produce XML output that is useful and other vendors produce show command output, and then you have to do screen scraping in Perl.
Yeah, well, there is that. And in fact, I mean, the NXOS commands I've been pulling are... They're not doing the straight screen scrape output, which is an option on some commands, like when you do a show configuration, for example. But the XML is certainly obscure and extremely hierarchical. Again, I've been whining on Twitter about this because, you know, wham me, because I'm like the first person ever to be annoyed by this naturally. And it is, when you compare, you know, I'll name names, when you compare, you know, what Junos puts out to what Cisco puts out, the difference is dramatic. I know which I prefer to work with, I'll be honest.
By the way, if you want to open a whole new can of worms, there is this programming language called XSLT, which can transform one XML into another XML. So if you don't like the Cisco XML, you can transform it into Junos XML by yourself.
Yeah, it's funny. I was considering committing suicide next week, but actually I might do that instead. So what? And this is actually one of the things that I know that you know, with TLF, you know, this idea of having the unified programming language, as you've talked about this before, about having a declarative language versus a procedural, and TLF talking about using Yang as their mechanism to try and, you know, like a dictionary, as it were, to convert between your declarative statements into something procedural. They can go throw an XML netconf at a device. I wish I understood that stuff better. It would probably make my life easier. But there's a lot to be said for that concept. Even if they are being sucked up into Cisco, the concept is still good of having that Rosetta Stone of, I just want to be able to say what I want to do once, and I want something else to figure out the background, how the heck to make this happen across 10 different platforms. And unfortunately, right now, I'm at the point where I'm trying to write the stuff for the 10 different platforms because I don't have that middleware to protect me from the nastiness of the implementations.
Now, just a crazy idea. If you would open source this thing, then other people would step in and start writing stuff for different platforms, wouldn't they?
They would. And that's kind of what I'm, with the F script, I've talked about putting that on GitHub. And so long as people can keep the laughter down, I would certainly appreciate the help on that because I'm sure it could be made more efficient. And additionally, at the moment, I have a specific set of things that I read. You know, I read Junos, I read F5, I read Cisco NXOS. And with the Junos, I can deal with the switching Junos as well as the firewall Junos and the routing Junos. It's all one Junos, right? But But even so, we know there are different flavors. But, you know, give me a different vendor's equipment and it's not going to cope with that. So even, you know, the ability to pass other configurations that may be useful going forward. So that's certainly on my radar as something that would be pretty good to put up there. And, you know, now I've got to the point where I'm pretty much towards the end of what I can do. It'd be lovely to, A, see if other people can use it and help me, as you say, refactor that into something that's more standardized, more generic, that could be deployed a bit more widely. And I think that'd be great to see. And honestly, I think having the help would be a great thing, because I kind of touched on it earlier about the idea of support. But when you write software and people start using it, you're on the hook until you go or they stop using it. You know, if there's a problem or if a code version changes or an API changes and your software breaks, people come straight back to you 3 years after you wrote the tool and say, hey, this doesn't work anymore. We rely on this in our workflow. And, you know, putting aside the scripts that I'm writing myself, this is something that we all have to bear in mind when we're writing these scripts, is we're also now, especially if you're not a programmer like me, you're now the support team as well. You're the bug tracker, you're the upgrader, you're the support team. And that's actually quite a load to take on, especially, as I said before, if it's not a primary part of your day job. You know, if you're expected to fix the bugs in your own time because it's not an official tool. And that's, I'm not sure that's always factored in. And that's sometimes why I just keep things to myself and just write tools for me, because I don't want to have to deal with it, to explain to other people how it works or to fix problems for them or to add features.
And this thing is not big enough that you would get like a half-time programmer to work on the code while you work on the features.
No, sadly not. I don't think anything that I could do would probably require a programmer. Yeah, there are some. My current client has some very good programmers, and they are all off doing their own thing. And this is a fun tool, but it is just that it's taking one little task and trying to make it easier. You know, along with some of the other stuff I'm doing to try and make things easier, it's just, you know, I'm lazy, right? And so I have a script that logs me into my boxes. And I'm not the first person to have an expect script to do this. It'll jump onto a Bastion host and then jump off. But the time saving every day from doing that is immense if you're jumping in and out of devices. I'm not sure I want to support it for everyone else, but, you know, I like these little tools that just help me do little bits and pieces.
Any other tool you want to share with us apart from this two that you just mentioned?
No, I've just got the things I'm on the go about. Everything else I do is little things. I did. I'll say, if anybody still uses NetScreens out there and wants a session table analyzer, they can always reach out to me. I did write one of those because we realized that it was very hard to get a good analysis of what was going on NetScreens. And in that environment, we had an awful, awful lot of sessions going on, far bigger than the online tool from Juniper could handle in terms of the session files. And so I wrote a tool that slices and dices the data 100 different ways. And that turned out to be a tremendously useful business tool, because we were able to see things happening on the network. We were able to see what people were using the network for with a level of visibility we never had before. Again, it's a little tool. It did its job. It performed a purpose, which was to figure out what was breaking our NetScreens at the time. And it's just a handy gadget. Maybe I should throw that up on GitHub as well and just let people attack it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what could you lose?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Stuff from my past.
Yeah, well, no, you just make sure that you point out that, you know, it's for you to take. If you use it, if you change it, please submit the changes back, but don't expect any support from my end.
Yeah, that sounds perfect.
Yeah, I mean, just write it down and publish it.
That is actually the GitHub thing. Even if it's a private project on GitHub, I have to say I'm very much getting to that point where writing scripts and putting them in some kind of Git repo, just so that you have version control, so that you have the ability to roll back stuff that you've done, is becoming progressively more important as a way to just manage my source code. And that's the usual hacker's way is, you know, we hack code, we don't have no stinking source control. I'm changing that, and I'm very much in favor now of throwing stuff in Git, even as a private project that only you can see, but just use that ability to back your code up somewhere and to have those have the previous revisions available, because it's invaluable.
Yeah, I can't tell you how much I agree with you. SVN has saved me so many times.
Yeah. Well, the problem is when we're not, you know, if you're a programmer by trade, you're probably used to working with some kind of source control.
You're so optimistic.
Yeah, maybe. At least a lot of companies force you to do it, right? Perhaps not enough, but a lot of companies do. But when you're on your own, you know, why would you have some kind of source control tool on your machine? That's just overkill, right?
No.
So I love that you got stuff like Git out there for free to do, and really does a very good job. A little bit arcane in its own way, but it's very effective.
Yeah, and it gives you another benefit. You have a backup somewhere in the cloud.
Oh, yeah.
By the way, you already mentioned the support issue. So if you write something, you release it, you never get rid of it. Are there any other downsides to writing the automation scripts?
Not really. The biggest one is time. It's just the whole thing we mentioned about, you know, they're usually written as a spare time task. They're usually supported as a spare time task. And I have to say, with scripts, you do sometimes get to the point where it's like, you know, I am done with this. I no longer wish to support this. And if you're that lone wolf, it's tough because there's no one else to hand it off to. And maybe that's where the open sourcing comes in. So I like the idea of getting other people involved. And I guess, you know, for a lot of us, for me, I don't like people seeing my code because I'm embarrassed by it. And that's just something I've got to get over. So maybe the downside is that people are going to want to see your code. But other than that, the end result is so useful. When you write a tool that works, it's wonderful.
Yeah, and don't worry about the source code. I mean, if someone takes the time and refactor it, you learn something from that. So you will be a better programmer.
Oh, for sure.
Anyway, how hard was it for you to start the whole thing? How hard is it for someone who doesn't have any experience to jump into this? Well, you may not remember because it was 20 years ago.
Well, actually, I'd say it's easier now than it ever was. Whether you're choosing Perl or Ruby or Python, I keep being told I should do Python. Really, just because the internet is such a fantastic resource for doing research. And this is why I was saying, so long as you have a mind that can nominally figure out the algorithmic steps to get from A to B, you may not know how to do something, but if you know, I need to sort these, I need to extract this, I need to look those up, and then I need to do something else, and you can figure those steps out, you can probably Google, how do I sort this? How do I sort an array? How do I do a regex match or whatever it is. And there are so many samples and so many sites out there. I think most of us and I call myself a hacker if that's not too presumptuous, use the internet as a way to, you know, borrow pieces of code that other people have spent the time to figure out in order to accelerate our development. Or it may be that I'm in on CPAN grabbing modules to do things, right? I'm using someone else's hard work. So it's a lot easier because there are more modules to do more things. So it's not that it's easy, but it's easier. And there's so many training resources now as well, free online training, so long as you like programming poker games and things like that.
By the way, you made an excellent point with this last remark. Go there and learn how to program properly. Either use an online resource or you buy a book and read it. But if you know nothing, just Googling for snippets that will solve your problem is, you know, like those network engineers we both love that Google for sample config and then they copy paste it into their network without knowing what they're doing.
There is that. Yeah, there's definitely a danger there. I mean, I started off Perl with a book that was like Learn Perl in 21 Days. I guarantee
exactly.
It took significantly longer than that, but it did at least give me a reference back to what the language was supposed to be doing. It gave me an understanding of the data types, and that's really what I needed. I am definitely a cut and paster for Python and Ruby. I do what I have to do to get it done, but I don't understand it, and that's why I don't write my tools in it, because I really don't have a clue. I'm just muddling by. In Perl, I'm a little bit more confident. But as you say, I did have the reference books there. And I want to understand what I'm doing. I don't just like cutting and pasting. I look at what it is and go, okay, oh, I see what they're doing now. I see how it achieves that. If I can't do that, then I usually can't customize it to what I want it to do. And maybe that's the step that's required. Maybe you're right, which is, you know, yes, use the internet, but make sure you understand what the heck it is you just cut and paste.
Yeah, well, first build the framework, understand the architecture, and then you can fill in the Lego bricks that you need.
Yeah, no, that's a good way of looking at it. The other thing I found over time is I'm on a number of support lists, both within work and outside, and people will ask a question like, how can I make widget X do Y and Z at the same time maintaining C? And people will spend ages trying to figure out how to make this work. And finally, someone asked the obvious question, which is, what were you actually trying to achieve by doing that? Oh, I needed it to do this. Oh, well, there's a module for that. There's a procedure.
Yeah, there's different widgets. Use that one.
Yeah. And so quite often people get tied up, especially when they're newer to it, in trying to do things the way that they imagine it should work and not being able to take that step back and say, okay, what am I trying to achieve? And then perhaps getting some help from someone else to say, ah, yeah, someone's been there before you. And actually, this is a better way to do it. I get schooled on that stuff all the time.
So this is the moment where I should start ranting about people moving VMs instead of using DNS, right?
How long is the podcast again?
Well, 6 hours.
That should just about cover it.
Yeah. Okay, coming back to programming. Any hints, recommendations, anything you would recommend to people who are just beginning to do these things?
Like I said earlier, the biggest thing for me is find an actual task that has a tangible result for you. I used Perl. I do a lot of text file processing, which works well with networking because most configurations are text-based in one way or another, and figure out a task that would interest you. You know, if you want to, maybe if you've got a list of configuration files and you might want to know, well, what SNMP strings do I have deployed? Okay, we'll start off by doing a grep. That's fine. Now figure out how to do the same thing in Perl, and now pretty the output up a bit and that kind of thing. I find that having actual real tasks is the best way to learn a language. Doing something abstract that doesn't interest you just to me feels like time wasting, and that's a real problem. It kind of clashes with the concept of go to a site and learn how to do it properly, but at the same time you want to go do something that actually is useful to you and doesn't feel like you're just treading water and fulfilling meaningless tasks. And that's certainly a problem I found with some of the online training. So for me, yes, yeah, by all means get the reference book that teaches you how to do stuff at a fundamental level, but when you actually want to start programming, it's to do something real. Because then at the end of the day, you get the satisfaction of having actually accomplished something, and that encourages you to stick at it and do the next thing. As I say, I can't tell you how many tasks I've solved over the years by being able to write Perl to analyze routing tables or configurations and static routes and this, that, and the other for, you know, thousands of routes that I could just never have done by hand, or it would have taken me far too long with far too many errors just because I said, okay, I've got to figure out how to do this. And I really think everyone should have, say should is a strong word, it will benefit anyone in network engineering to have some scripting capabilities.
No, this is the RFC should.
Yeah, I'll put it in capital letters.
Yes. Unless there is a really good reason not to do it, you must do it. That's the should.
Well, and that's certainly becoming more and more, you know, as we know, that's more and more the world we're in. So it can only help in a whole variety of ways. But, you know, even if you ignore trying to automate the network, just trying to automate little bits of your job could be a huge benefit.
By the way, since you mentioned that you've solved thousands of different problems with little tools,
yep.
Have you documented that somewhere, or will you?
No, and probably not.
Hey, most too of them, bad.
Yeah, I know. Well, so most of them tend to be very mission specific tasks, especially with routing tables and things. They're things where I might need to pull out routes, next hops, and metrics so that I can figure out which ones are going in a particular direction, and then I know which ones I'm going to replace with static routes, or I'm going to move to BGP. And then, well, I may as well generate the BGP config while I'm at it because I just extracted all that information anyway. So it's that kind of thing where it's like it's not really reusable. So I have a lot of one-off scripts that do something,
yeah, but
for a project.
But still, you know, just documenting this would put people in the right mindset?
Well, maybe I can start doing that. I think my mindset's just been, I do the tool, I move on, with a few exceptions. But no, you're probably right. I stand gently chastised.
Okay, so talking about your blog, John, where can people find you?
I'm on there at lamejournal.com. Don't ask why, it just is. It's the way it's ended up. And they can also, I'm on Twitter as Mr. Tugs, if anybody wants to hit me up there.
Oh, definitely. And what are your plans for the next days?
Oh, these specific next few days, I'm going up to upstate New York. I've got a drive from Atlanta to there, so that's about a 1,500 mile each way, which will keep me busy for a few days. And then just back to work, so back to the grindstone.
So you're going on vacation?
I'm taking my children up for vacation, yeah, and then driving back. So I've got a 3,000 mile round trip, and then in a few weeks' time, I get to do it again and go pick them up.
Okay.
Never let it be said Americans don't love our cars, right?
What can I say? Enjoy the trip.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And thanks very much for joining me today. I'm Ivan Pipelnyak, and you can find me at ipspace.net. And if you really want to follow me on Twitter, you can find me there as ioshints. Whatever John sends me as the show notes, you'll find them at podcast.ipspace.net, where you'll also find a subscribe link. And if you want to know more about SDN and other resources that are available on my website, go to ipspace.net/SDN. Finally, if you liked our chat, tell a friend, leave a review on iTunes. The podcast is now properly incorporated on iTunes. And don't forget to follow us at podcast.ipspace.net.